Podcasts from the South are a series of conversations created by Maria de Guzman at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Claudia Millan at Duke University. Joining us for this segment is author and professor Lorraine Lopez from Vanderbilt University. Our topic, the South, Southernness, and Latinos and Latinas. What are their intersections?
Thank you, Maria and Claudia, for inviting me to take part in this conversation. I'm thrilled to be here, and I've been giving some thought to the topics. And in particular, a few things that I find most distinctive about the South with regard to Latinos and Latinas. One, first, is the overriding racial binary that refuses to reckon with the growing and influential Latino presence. And the second is the stereotyping of Latinos and Latinas in the South as an immigrant, migrant, transient presence that does not require serious acknowledgement.
Can you give us a few examples of how the binary, the racial binary, by which I assume you mean the black-white binary, and also the idea of transience and never belonging, work themselves out in one, everyday lived experience, and two, in the study of what is conceptualized as the South?
Yes, I'm thinking of where I'm from, which is Nashville. I live in Nashville, Tennessee. And I'm thinking about daily encounters with people. And one can very easily move about the city of Nashville, Tennessee, and not ever have to seriously engage with a person who's Latino, Latina, in a way that one would engage with friends, neighbors, family members, even though that presence is growing. And it would be very difficult to go through a day without encountering a Latina or a Latino. However, that person will be relegated to the margins of one's life because of social strata. And usually more recent immigrants will be in entry-level positions in the service industry, construction. So you will encounter people, gardeners, for example, you'll encounter people throughout the day, but you won't have to deal with them as you would deal with the people who you enact and transact emotional exchanges and important communication. So as long as they're in the periphery, you don't have to reckon with that presence. And when you're grappling in the South with that terrible history of slavery, and you're burdened with grief and guilt by that history, this becomes another layer of weight on one's conscience. And if one chooses not to interact directly with Latinos and Latinas, one does not have to work through that. That's my example in daily life. And insofar as in an institution, in an educational environment, teaching Latino and Latina studies, I often experience resistance on the part of students who feel that terrible guilt and grief about the history of the South. And they feel consumed by it sometimes, and they don't want to have to now deal with another source of guilt and grief and their pinpricks of conscience because of privilege with regard to another group. It becomes too much, and it becomes difficult for them to talk about and difficult for them to understand.
Those are great points, Lorraine. It also makes me think about my work in my department through Roman Studies at Duke and so many non-Latino students who are learning Spanish, and I always like to remind them about their ethical relationship to language as students who are essentially bilingual and become bilingual and know the other language in many ways intimately since they go abroad for a semester and pick it up really well. And here in Durham, for instance, it makes me wonder about how do they relate to the language when they go out to eat and they hear Spanish all over the place, especially as it's coming out of kitchens and it's coming through the people who service them. Certainly the landscape in Durham, we can see so many signs in Spanish, so many of the workers who paint signs that are very evocative of what you see on these roads of Mexico or many parts of Latin America, this particular craft that is all over the southeastern landscape, side by side with more formal signs or even African-American symbols. Yet it also made me wonder what you said about what a great opportunity it is to start picking up and opening up even the question of the South, since as a region, it also has functioned as this kind of national myth of separation for the rest of the nation in its particular perceived distinction, as perhaps even Uncle Sam's other province. So I'm wondering if we have other thoughts here about the relationship of the South in general to Latino studies.
And when you say Uncle Sam's other province, you're also thinking about that long history of the South as the peculiar institution and also the whole movement of Southern separatism, I'm assuming, right? Which also affected other parts of the South, including the Southwest, if we think of Texas wanting to be kind of the Lone Star State. So is that part of what you're
referring to? Yes, I mean, absolutely. And it's one that is also links up with the other forms of even Latin formations, if you will.
Right.
I'm thinking about William Faulkner's idea that the South is not a place as much as an idea and a certain emotional space. And for me, that means it's a place where certain narratives are produced, narratives that create this character of the South and the Southern people. And I think at this particular historic moment, it's a very unique and exciting opportunity to insert the Latino-Latina presence into this narrative and to foreground that presence that is now in the background. And I think we're at a great juncture in our lives as writers, as scholars, because this is our work, is to bring that presence through our work to the foreground for our students and also in our writing, to inscribe it in a way that is not what is the usual song and dance, the usual expectation.
Exactly, and how that particular history is so entangled so much with other forms of just Latin American or Latino being. I'm thinking about where you are and just the legacy of that space in relation to Vanderbilt or even William Walker, all these other forms that have sparked in many ways the Latino diaspora or rootedness or have expanded this kind of other Southern ambitions, let's say through Central America and other plantation economies that should have emerged but didn't. And so, again, it's this particular invisibilities of historical narratives that, while may not be explicitly grounded within on-site U.S.-American history, are still nevertheless part of the larger narrative that has made Latino or contributed to a Latino being in the larger sense.
Yeah, that's very interesting, all the things that you mentioned there, because it also reminds me, too, the way in which when you think about the South as being constantly created by these stories and the retellings of history, that a lot of Southern history has actually been, in a sense, occluded from Southerners. In other words, that there are parts of their history that get told over and over and over again, but there are other parts that have been erased, where you do see traces of it quite clearly. If you look, for instance, at all the Spanish names on the state maps of all of the Southern states, not just the Southwestern states, but the states of the Southeast, that's one layer of history that has been occluded from the telling of Southern stories. The idea of the expansion of the Southern Empire of the plantation empire, which was supposed to have expanded all the way down into South America, you know, according to 19th century ideology, and the way in which that's kind of been forgotten, which would have of course involved a tremendous intersection between the South and and what is considered to be Latina, Latino. So I guess a question I have, or just thinking about it here, is how does one start to tell and retell those stories, both creatively but also in terms of one's scholarship?
Well, I think that's work that you've done, Maria, in your, I'm thinking of your introduction to the Oxford Book of the South, in which you recognize that some of the, well, the first book in this nation was written by Brother Baez,
mm-hmm.
and also recognizing those early presences, Latino-Latina presences in New Orleans. So this is one way to bring those stories to the surface that have been submerged and eclipsed with the influx of immigrants, which has been considerable. So, and that tends to be the overriding narrative, that these are transient people, these are immigrant people, and this kind of blocks out our understanding. Well, no, this is a presence that was here long before the South as we know it came to be.
That has long historical roots. But even within the question of the layer of the transient immigrant presence, it seems to me that the same problem has played itself out in the sense that people tend to think of that presence as very, very recent, when in fact it can be traced back to before World War II, if not longer than that. And I'm just wondering, how does one start to both look for and also create stories of the South that connect these different disjointed layers, well, what have become disjointed layers of history? They are, of course, are joined, but in our minds they're not joined, and that's part of our problem of trying to understand where we are.
Right, and it they're not disjointed in our work or even our approach to the region. I think that those kinds of questions also need to be taken up even in the context of what comprises African American literature.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what I've shown in my work has been, for instance, the case of writers as foundational, as James Weldon Johnson from the Harlem Renaissance, who's the biography of an ex-colored man is infused with Cuba and Southern migrations. So it's curious to add this migration narrative only in the context of Latinos when you think about larger forms of the great migration from South to North. So we're talking about African Americans and Latinos who are very much split by a North-South divide. And that it is all over the work in ways that either African American bodies passing by standing as a signifier of something Latin, Mexican, or Spanish, picking up Spanish, speaking it as good as, quote, the native, unquote. And those are the kinds of things that I think are dual directional. And so we are talking about Latino studies, but it's also something that should give particular occasion for African-American studies, Southern studies, and American studies to pick up.
Well, it's very interesting that you should say that, because my understanding is that at least a quarter of Latinos actually identify as Afro-Latino. So that's a significant number of people.
So that the black and white binary is being disrupted to the extent that you have a continuous flow of Latino bodies in various shades, whether it's brown, dark brown, or black, that pass through it, and even through off-whiteness or whiteness, and sort of defy it or remake it through daily life.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the South, we have a very unusual set of circumstances that, this is something that you've observed, Maria, as well. If you are a Latina or a Latino or Asian in the South, you will either get subsumed into that binary. You will have to choose, are you a person of color or are you white? That binary will make you choose which side to be on, and you will be that person in the South. And I witnessed it firsthand with my children when we moved from Los Angeles to the South. In their high school, their colleagues, I guess you call them in high school, didn't quite know what to do with them. And they had to choose where to sit at the lunch table. And that was where they were for the rest of the year. And my daughter identified with African American friends. So that was the table that she sat at. And my son identified with weird nerdy white kids, and that was the table that he sat at. But my son is very dark, and my daughter's very light. So it was just so strange that they would have to make this choice. But it is not uncommon. Where are you going to align on this side or the other? The binary forces this.
Sure, I'm not arguing that it doesn't or that it doesn't exist, but yet it's also very nuanced, and I think you see it through, for instance, just going to the Mexican supermarket or the world supermarket. What is always curious to me is see the ways that there are so many Latinos married to whites or African-Americans, and so you have so many assemblages of global South populations, if you will, that are picking up or that are all these different forms of mixture. For instance, one of my students is an African-American, and she's the only one who is at Duke who's learning Maya Quiche. So she speaks Spanish. So I'm just thinking of, yes, the very serious expectations about how to inhabit the black-white world. But again, it's one of those moments that it's about also troubling it and unsettling it that I think also push my thinking and propel this very compelling moment in terms of the transformations of the South for me.
Well, and clearly what's happening, it seems, is that both are operative. I mean, you have the old black-white binary constantly reasserting itself, but you also have these types of transformative moments. And then another question I have is, what are the uses, perhaps, since we were talking about transience, but what are the uses of categories such as misrecognition or identification, disidentification? Sometimes people complain, I was misrecognized as something. Somebody took me to be something that I actually don't consider myself to be. But are there moments like that where you see people actually taking kind of an opportunity to create a new kinds of being in the moments of misrecognition in your areas you are?
I can think of two, in literature.
Whichever.
And I think immediately of Judith Ortiz Cofer's statement, I was born a white girl in Puerto Rico and I became a brown girl in the United States. Mm-hmm. And this was a misrecognition on both sides. She was always a woman of color, and yet she was perceived to be white in Puerto Rico because of her skin color. And when she came to the U.S., she became a person of color. And the other example is Piri Tomas, mm-hmm. who wrote Down These Mean Streets years and years ago. And he was Puerto Rican with Afro Caribbean Puerto Rican, who was racially marked as Afro-Caribbean, mm-hmm. and he confronted his blackness in the Northeast, but when he came south, he became African-American as opposed to Afro-Caribbean in a very distinctive and jarring, if not shocking, way. The context created the misrecognition. Those are two examples that I teach, and it's very, very difficult for people to understand. Well, is he black? I didn't get. How is he black and Puerto Rican? How can that be? And those conversations can be very, very productive.
And in teaching that in those texts, for instance, those two texts, those are good examples. What sort of reactions do you get? What's the spectrum?
Lots of confusion at first. My Southern students they want to use the binary, but the binary fails them.
Right.
Is he black? I didn't. How can he be both? And just getting to the point in our classroom discourse where we understand, yes, and we can be Puerto Rican, we can be black, and the context creates the misrecognition. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the question is, how is Latino understood in all our Southern contexts? What is the visuality, let's say, or how of epidermally of what a Latino is supposed to look like? Because for me, it is misrecognition, but it's also very rich moments of provisional identities. So that the moment you could be something else, why is that necessarily something that is, quote, bad, unquote. You pass for that misrecognized moment for something else that wasn't yourself.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that misrecognition is not necessarily a bad thing. It actually might be a really creative moment.
Right, because they're all over, like, literature. I mean, that's what passing literature absolutely is about. And it so, is, I mean, I think even reading the John Leguizamo memoir, it has a very colorful title, and he's basically... What's interesting to me about that book is that he's talking about all these Hollywood actors that have passed for Latino or Latin, and he mentions Al Pacino. And what's interesting for me was Leguizamo saying, well, I'm the one who wants to pass for that Latin something that everyone else has inhabited. But, you know, and in terms of literature, I think the most fascinating book for me is actually Sandra Cisneros' Caramelo, because it's the very rich spectrum of all these forms of darkness, of being dark, that is brown, dark brown caramelo, mm-hmm. peanut butter burnt, or mm-hmm. looking like a burnt candy or penny. But it's never really taking it to that particular blackness. And mm-hmm. the moment that blackness does get mentioned is when Lala's father, as a dishwasher in Arkansas, says that, evokes that popular saying from Latin America that it's the first time that he worked as a black person. Mm-hmm. And that's a very curious moment of racialization, that the black becomes something else, but yet it's sensorial because he's exhausted. And so he somehow feels that abjection.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and those moments of misrecognition and passing, I think they can be really, really powerful optics. And they're opportunities for seeing things in ways that one maybe had never experienced them or understood. There's a great deal of empathy that can be gained for being taken for what you did not conceive yourself to be, but what you appear to be as what you appear to be to others, in a different context.
Yes, and I'm also wondering if such moments actually help students who haven't really had to think about this with regard to their identity, because they might be in a normative category where they live or where they work or where they're going to school, to see their own histories in a different way. I'm just wondering if you get those types of reactions from students who might be considered to be very much part of the mainstream, the normative, the, I don't know, Anglo, even the upper class or the upper middle class. And this is a moment where they're seeing misrecognition, and perhaps it allows them to see their own history, which often is just lost under the cover of something called whiteness, in a different way.
Sure.
Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does. And I'm wondering if we can also add to that the fact that it's not just that moment of racialization, but also regionalization or national becoming. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering as well how any of your students perhaps resist the South.
Oh, yes, they do. Many do. People who come from California, from the North, they experience something like culture shock, but not as intense as I've seen other students who come from Asia suffer very, very severely. But it is disconcerting to find themselves in an environment where they seem to experience groupthink. And I think this is an experience of those overriding narratives, mm-hmm. and it's very compounding. And it's very disturbing. There have been circumstances where people have just dealt with it for a semester and left. Just mm-hmm. couldn't stay.
And I remember how surprised, or maybe not surprised, I just was taken aback when one of my students shared with me that he was from North Carolina and he had to train himself not to speak with a Southern accent. So there was a moment of obviously regionalism, but also perhaps class within the context of attending an institution such as Duke.
Yeah, that's very mm-hmm. interesting. And then, of course, there's the phenomenon of Latinos who are actually inflecting Southern English with their own forms of Spanish. This hasn't been studied as much as it should be, but I was wondering if any of you have any experience with these types of new mixtures that are being created, which, of course, then changes our notion of what Southern English is, or what Spanish or Spanglish is. Any experiences with those in your areas?
I have overheard construction workers in the supermarket speaking this It sounded Southern, but it was also, there were Spanish words in it, and it was just really, really interesting. I couldn't stop myself to listen to it. But that's very limited. I would like to hear more of it. It was very strange and very wonderful to hear.
Yeah, it's curious you mentioned the construction moment. Once I was just driving down by an auto repair shop, and I had to stop and take a picture, and I'm a timid driver as it is, but it had mofles y frenos. And it was like mofles. It took me a while to think, oh my gosh, it's mufflers. But because it was in a predominantly African-American neighborhood, that for me wasn't your typical Spanglish. It became another marker of something else that was very much a testament to the particular space it inhabited.
Right, and of inhabiting a particular place, which is this thing that we're calling the South.